Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What were the holidays like after the shocking bombing that pulled the U.S. into the Second World War? As Americans were coming to grips with the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor and the reality that a generation of young men would soon be called to fight, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill was crossing the Atlantic, arriving in Washington on December 22nd. He would spend that Christmas at the White House, but of course the purpose of his visit was far more sober, as Churchill and FDR and their teams spent long hours discussing the role the United States should take now that it was finally joining the fight in earnest. Stanley Weintraub is Professor Emeritus of Arts and Humanities at Penn State University and author of the new book Pearl Harbor Christmas, A World at War, December 1941. Stan, welcome to Think.
I'm glad to be with you.
President Roosevelt initially wanted a bit more time to plan with his own team before extensive meetings with Churchill. How did he decide to invite the prime minister to arrive, in fact, just a few days before Christmas?
Winston Churchill invited himself. He was very eager to cross the Atlantic and meet with President Roosevelt because he knew, for one thing, that the Americans would be so angered by the attack on Pearl Harbor that they would want to fight the war with Japan first. Mm-hmm. And leave England possibly dangling slowly in the wind. He wanted Germany first, and he came over to try to use his overwhelming personality to convince the American government and the American military that they had to not only aid England, but attack Germany first and win the war over Germany first. He wanted to fly, but the North Atlantic in December was so stormy, and the range of aircraft was so limited that his people felt it much safer if he went by ship. And he did use the fastest and newest battleship in the British Navy, the Duke of York, to cross the North Atlantic.
It was still a somewhat longer trip than he would have liked and expected based on the weather. How did he spend that time at sea from London? How did Churchill spend his time while he was at sea?
Churchill spent his time on board working out position papers to present to President Roosevelt and his military chiefs. And he also spent a lot of time watching everybody else be seasick. He was not. He not only could handle it, but he brought with him a patent medicine called Mothersill Seasick Remedy. And he was okay through the trip.
Once he was on dry land, he rode to the White House in a limousine with an interesting history.
It was an unusual limousine. It was also an unusual greeting. President Roosevelt, who was handicapped by polio paralysis since 1921, usually did not go to greet visitors at airports. He had only done so once before in his life, and he did go to meet Churchill at the Anacostia Naval Airport near Washington, D.C. Churchill had come into Newport News, Virginia, and eager to get to Washington as soon as he could. He had radioed ahead, and an airplane was sent to take him and a few members of his staff to Washington. Roosevelt greeted him in an armored limousine. The limousine had belonged to gangster Al Capone and was confiscated by the Treasury Department. The president didn't have his own armored vehicle yet. One would be made for him, I think, by Chrysler Corporation. But at that point, he used Al Capone's limousine, and they went immediately to the White House.
Who were the most important advisors to accompany Churchill on that trip to Washington?
Churchill's chief advisor turned out not to be anybody on the military staff, but Lord Beaverbrook. Lord Beaverbrook was a former Canadian press baron who had become a newspaper owner in England and had moved up from Minister of Aircraft Production to Minister of Production in general. So he was in charge of all of British military industry. And his chief aim over in Washington was to convince American industrialists that they had to do more and they had to do it faster. And he was very successful and very persuasive.
And it's so interesting to think about this. For Churchill and for his team, it was a somewhat surreal experience to find themselves in a place that had not yet been dealing with rationing or shortages. America at that point was still quite a land of plenty.
America was still well lit. The shops were full of Christmas goodies. There was no rationing yet. It was a totally different world. And there was a kind of parallel reality in America at that time. There was the shock of war and defeat and destruction, but at a great distance from the United States. And there was the prosperity that was post-depression and was basically the result of war industry.
Mm-hmm.
So Americans were relatively prosperous. People could buy automobiles. They soon wouldn't be able to. They soon would have rationing of tires. They would soon have rationing of gasoline by limiting speed limit to 35 miles an hour, and later on real rationing of gasoline. But at this point, there was nothing of the sort. There were even nylon stockings in the shops for women. This was a new product, and women were delighted with it. Churchill even telephoned his wife in London and asked her stocking size so he could bring Clementine some nylons. But even those would disappear because nylon would be used for parachutes.
So, Stan, what was the mood among the American people about this holiday season? On the one hand, you know, they want to celebrate. They've put up all their decorations. They're buying things. And on the other hand, there had to be this sense of dread for what was coming.
That's why I talked about it as a sense of parallel reality.
Yeah.
They didn't know how bad the damage was at Pearl Harbor, but they did know on Christmas Day that Wake Island had been occupied by the Japanese and all of the people on the island taken prisoner and subject to a good deal of brutality. Guam, another island that we owned in the Central Pacific, had been captured on the first day of the war. Midway Island had been shelled. The Philippine Islands had been bombed on the first day of the war, even though General MacArthur had been telephoned about Pearl Harbor and told to get his planes up in the air and to be alert. It didn't do any good. MacArthur's planes were on the ground when the Japanese attacked, and half his Air Force was destroyed at Clark Field on the ground. This was true across the Pacific. We did not know that the Japanese would be attacking Pearl Harbor, but we had broken the Japanese diplomatic code, and we knew that the Japanese were getting more and more belligerent and that they would break relations with us, and that seemed like the imminence of war. As a result, the Navy and the Army headquarters in Washington sent out cables to all the bases in the Pacific on the 27th of November, reading at the this is the quote from the beginning of the cable, this is a war warning, and nobody paid attention. No matter how close they were to Japan, nobody paid attention. And no one really thought that the Japanese could make a sneak raid in a powerful sense on Pearl Harbor, which was thousands of miles from Japan. Certainly they would have been spotted, but American culture was different at the time. It was a weekend. We didn't pay attention to alertness on weekends, and Pearl Harbor happened on a Sunday.
I mean, hindsight is always 20/20. But are you arguing that we should have known and had at least better defenses so that not as much damage would have been suffered at Pearl Harbor and elsewhere?
We actually had maneuvers at Pearl Harbor over the whole extent of the 1930s, maneuvers defending against an attack from the sea, attacked by the enemy. The only enemy possible would have been Japan. And despite those maneuvers and the realization that we had to be alert, the general in charge of the Army and the Air Force and the admiral in charge of the Pacific Fleet were planning to play golf at 8 o'clock in the morning on Sunday.
Hmm.
And on board ships in the Pacific and in Pearl Harbor itself, Sunday church services were being planned on deck for 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock. So there was absolutely no alertness, and no one assumed that there would be an attack. We had primitive radar that, in fact, was not supposed to be on because it was a weekend. And one GI went out to test the radar because he wanted to learn how to use it. And he found blips approaching on his radar screen. And he called into the Air Force in Army headquarters. The Air Force was part of the Army then. And he was told, oh, don't worry about those. They're B-17 bombers of ours that are coming in from California that are going to augment our Air Force. They were, actually. And the bombers that came in at the same time the Japanese Air Force attacked from their aircraft carriers were shot down.
So at this time, throughout this time, you have General Douglas MacArthur stationed in the Philippines with his family at the time because there was a large base there. What were his duties there, and then what vision did he have for his role once the war was underway?
General MacArthur had been retired from the Army after his term as Chief of Staff. He went to the Philippines as Commander-in-Chief of the Philippine Army and was made a Field Marshal. He loved that idea of being a Field Marshal. At the time of the war began, he had been reinstated in the Army with the rank of Lieutenant General. He was still a Field Marshal in the Philippine Army, and he had a big expense account from the Philippine government, which really was our money because we were supporting the Philippine government, which was not yet completely free.
Sure.
So he was earning three salaries at the time, doing very well. He had a seven-bedroom penthouse suite at the top of the Manila Hotel. He lived in kingly fashion and was definitely not on the alert. He enjoyed his life there. And when the war began, it was 3 o'clock in the morning in Manila, and he was awakened and told about Pearl Harbor, and he did nothing, he was sleepy, but nevertheless, he did nothing. He didn't order anything done by his subordinates. We were attacked before there was any kind of alert out in the Philippines. By Christmas Eve, Luzon, the main island of the Philippines, was invaded, and Manila was about to fall. And MacArthur fled to Corregidor Island in Manila Bay, where he stayed for several months before he was evacuated to Australia. But that was not the way his communiques read. He wrote his own communiques, and he lied. Let's say he also had a parallel reality. He lied. He said that the Japanese were being driven off. He claimed that his tanks and his planes were succeeding against the Japanese when they weren't at all. And we were shocked when we discovered on New Year's Day that Manila had fallen and MacArthur was no longer in charge of anything but Corregidor Island and the little peninsula of Bataan in Manila Bay. It looked like a thumb sticking out into Manila Bay. That was all MacArthur had left at that time, and yet he made a bogus effort to describe Bataan as his secure place. It was surrounded. There was almost no food left on the peninsula. He was only there once during his entire stay in the Philippines. He was there for 1 hour, and yet he called his circle the Bataan Gang, and he named his plane the Bataan. It was all a lie.
Stanley Weintraub is my guest. He's Professor Emeritus of Arts and Humanities at Penn State University and author of the new book Pearl Harbor Christmas, A World at War, December 1941. We'll take your calls now. We have lines open at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Stanley Weintraub. He's Professor Emeritus of Arts and Humanities at Penn State University and author of the new book Pearl Harbor Christmas, A World at War, December 1941. Join the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org. Stan, what sort of commitment had the U.S. made to Great Britain before Pearl Harbor?
The commitment that Roosevelt made to Churchill was nothing that was put in writing.
Mm-hmm.
They met once before during the war. They met off the coast of Canada on the cruiser Augusta. Roosevelt and Churchill talked about what the U.S. could do. Churchill wanted the United States to come in quite openly against Germany. And Roosevelt said he could do whatever he could short of war because the isolationist feeling in the United States was so strong that there was no chance that there could be a declaration of war against Hitler's Germany. He said he would do what he could. He would help shepherd war material to Britain. And this was dangerous because the Germans might sink American ships. But if they did, that would be a provocation that might help speed American interest in getting into the war. After that, we did lose several destroyers to German submarines. But the loss of the Kearney and the Greer and the Reuben James did nothing to make Congress angry enough to declare war. In fact, we never did declare war against Germany until Germany declared war against us. Hitler got on radio 2 days after Pearl Harbor and announced that he was coming to the aid of Japan because they had a treaty that would mean that he would come to Japan's aid if Japan got into a war. But actually, that was only if Japan were attacked, and Japan was not attacked. It attacked us. Nevertheless, he boasted, Japan has never lost a war in 3,000 years of its history. So this was a great event and a great bargain for the Germans to come in and have the American effort divided rather than used just against Germany. Churchill knew that would happen, and he worried that we put too much effort into attacking Japan and not enough into helping Britain. And Roosevelt's chief aim, although he didn't make that public, was that he wanted to keep Russia in the war. Russia had been attacked in June 1941. By the way, it was also on a Sunday, attacked by the Germans. To keep Russia in the war meant providing them with war material. Russia could just as easily have made a bargain with the Germans and gotten out of the war and left Britain alone. So one thing we had to do was to increase our arms manufacture and send planes and tanks and build ships for Russia. Lord Beaverbrook, who I mentioned earlier, had talked to the American industrialists and pointed out that in one battle alone, the Russians had lost 3,000 tanks in fighting the Germans. How long will it take you, he said, to replace 3,000 tanks? America had to quit production of automobiles and trucks and refrigerators and start building tanks and airplanes. And he suggested this astronomical numbers that had to be built. And they were awed by what they thought they had to do. But he said, England has one quarter of the American population and no natural resources, and yet it is building more war equipment than you are.
Hmm.
And by 1943, we were building nearly 90,000 planes a year. And Henry Kaiser alone at his shipyards was launching a ship a day. Lord Beaverbrook was persuasive.
Churchill and FDR also had to tread carefully with regard to Russia in that Russia was not at war with Japan.
Russia was not at war with Japan, but that didn't make any difference to us because we had enough to do. We had enough to supply them just to keep them at war with Germany. Eventually, we made a bargain with Russia. This would have been late in the war, to go to war against Japan because we thought that might save us from having to invade Japan with casualties in the hundreds of thousands, if not millions. We were saved that by the atomic bomb. But the day the atomic bomb was dropped, Russia rushed into the war because they wanted to get some spoils out of Japan. Hmm. That's, of course, another story. Our story is about England pressing the United States to do everything it could to fight a two-ocean war. Two-ocean war was something we feared because we didn't have the equipment, the men, anything to fight a two-ocean war. We had a peacetime draft for the first time in our history, and yet in October 1941, just before Pearl Harbor, General Marshall, the chief of staff, had to go to the House of Representatives and plead with them to extend the draft another year. And he was able to get the draft extended by exactly one vote, which gives you an idea how passive America still was about fighting a war.
So
it took Japan to do it.
In Churchill and FDR, you have these two very different personalities united by a common purpose. Can you talk a little bit about their styles and their approach to work and about the line between business and recreation and how it all played out between them personally?
They teamed up, although they were certainly very different personalities. Churchill was very active and a person who was very voluble, loved to be witty. Roosevelt, on the other hand, had to move about in a wheelchair. He had an old kitchen chair with wheels on it that he used as a wheelchair. He had been a polio victim since 1921, so his activity had to be much more restricted than Churchill's. But they made a great show of partnership, and it was a true partnership through the war. It really began with that visit to the White House. Churchill was the man who came to dinner. Mm. He didn't leave. He was something of a pest in the White House. He didn't like the bedroom he was offered at first, and he picked out another one himself. But he was introduced to the press corps, the newspaper men and radio people in the White House at a press conference. And because he was short and pudgy, he stood on a chair so they could see him. Something that Roosevelt obviously could not do. The next day, he helped Roosevelt light the Christmas tree on the White House lawn. This was something that could never have been done in England because of blackouts. And then the day after Christmas, he spoke to Congress. Roosevelt didn't even go deliberately. He wanted to give all the attention to Churchill, and he listened on the radio. And Churchill pointed out in his speech that if his father were American and his mother were English instead of the other way around, his mother, Jenny Jerome, was from New York City. Mm-hmm. He said perhaps he would have stood there in front of Congress in another capacity. Hmm. In other words, with his energy and charisma, maybe he would have been president standing in front of Congress. And they laughed and enjoyed him as a showman. But he was more than a showman. His aim was to build American strategy and American interest in the war.
Christmas Eve, 1941, was the only time that FDR and Churchill would give a speech from the same platform. Can you talk about what they said in that address?
Churchill and Roosevelt only spoke from the same platform once, and that was lighting the Christmas tree on Christmas Eve. Churchill spoke about his being half American and feeling at home in America. And yet, at the same time, he reached out to the children and said, let the children have a season of happiness. And he hoped that Father Christmas would be good to them. Then no one knew who Father Christmas was. That's the English term for Santa Claus. Mm-hmm. Roosevelt, on the other hand, spoke about peace and strength and the fact that we had to win the war in cooperation with the British and that we certainly would. He felt that there was no chance that we would not come through to victory.
Meanwhile, in Germany, you have Adolf Hitler having decided that the United States is, in fact, the great enemy of his in this war, and also asking the German people in a sort of veiled, I suppose, acknowledgement that German troops didn't always have everything they needed, asking them to donate warm clothing to soldiers.
this was a very unusual event for Hitler. The Germans expected to win over Russia very quickly. They thought that Russia would collapse within and the war would be over before winter. It did not happen. And on the very weekend of Pearl Harbor, Russian troops were stopped in the snow in the outskirts of Moscow. And although they surrounded Leningrad, now renamed St. Petersburg, they never did capture it. It had been under it was, in fact, under siege for 800 days before it could break that siege. The troops that the Russians faced had summer clothing. The Germans didn't come with winter clothing because they thought it would be over. It was up to Hitler to go on radio and ask the German people to donate warm clothing for their troops in Russia. And that was an admission that things were going very badly. And when he said, donate them as Christmas presents for the troops, the mention of Christmas itself was shocking because the Nazis had replaced Christmas with their own religion of Nazism, and that wasn't mentioned. People were not allowed to send Christmas cards. In fact, they were banned from being manufactured. And later on New Year's Day, he spoke again, this time to the troops, and told them that it would be a tough year ahead in 1942. But he said, with God's will, we will win. And that may have been the first time he mentioned God in all of his speeches. So this was a very unusual and dismaying Christmas, not only for Americans, but for the enemy.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Email address is think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Sue in Dallas, who writes, I thought there was evidence Roosevelt knew the Japanese were coming. He did not heed the warning due to wanting the U.S. to be provoked into war and therefore get the population behind the war effort. Perhaps, Sue writes, this thought of mine comes from the movie Tora, Tora, Tora.
Well, of course, Roosevelt did not know. Conspiracy theories have been out there for years and years and years. We had not broken the Japanese Admiralty Code, the Naval Code, until after the war began. We did not know the Japanese were coming. There were some, we knew that they would break relations with us and that war would occur somewhere. And the British intelligence reported that the Japanese would be likely to attack Malaya and Thailand in Southeast Asia. And possibly also the Philippines. But nobody thought in terms of Pearl Harbor. On the other hand, we had one spy, a double agent, who was known as Tricycle, a Bulgarian who was a double agent for the British, who came to America, talked with the chief spymaster for the British in New York City, who took the man to see J. Edgar Hoover. He told him that the Germans were interested in finding out what was going on at Pearl Harbor, and this for the Japanese Navy, that they wanted to know how deep the harbor was and whether there were submarine nets up and so on. And this warning should be passed on to the American military. And J. Edgar Hoover was very skeptical. This is a double agent, and he's very likely trying to mislead us. And he never reported anything to the military. So we owe it to J. Edgar Hoover that we knew nothing about the actual Japanese intentions.
Stan, aside from political feasibility and public opinion, did Roosevelt himself agree relatively easily that the right move would be to send U.S. troops first to Europe and then focus on Asia?
Yes, he did. He was not persuaded by Churchill. He had agreed to that himself with his own military people because we knew that our power in the Pacific had been terribly hobbled. We had lost 8 battleships at Pearl Harbor. We did not have a sufficient fleet to go out after the Japanese. We had no way to come to the aid of the Philippines. They would just have to wither because we couldn't get to them, and we'd have to send our supplies by way of Australia, which was very distant. There was no way we could attack the Japanese until we got stronger. Fortunately, as he knew and as he didn't tell the American people yet, we had not lost any aircraft carriers at Pearl Harbor. We had 2 aircraft carriers at sea, one going to Wake Island to bring planes to Wake, and the other going to Midway Island to bring planes there. and they were on a ferrying mission. As a result, they were not at Pearl Harbor when the Japanese attacked, and the Japanese thought there was an aircraft carrier there. The old battleship Utah was the target ship. It had lumber on the decks that would be used to absorb dummy bombs, and the lumber on the decks made it look like an aircraft carrier, and the Japanese bombed it to the bottom of Pearl Harbor, where it still is, by the way. Most people think the Arizona is the only ship at the bottom because there is a big memorial to the Arizona, but the Utah was also sunk. In fact, three ships were sunk with men entombed on board. The Arizona lost over 1,000 men, and the other two had hundreds aboard. And on the Oklahoma itself, it was discovered when the ship was finally righted, it had been capsized, that there were men still alive on Christmas Eve because they had marked, they had been marking on the walls the days. But that was all. We had no way to attack the Japanese right away. We had to go after the Germans.
There was also discussion between Churchill and FDR about the U.S. possibly making headway in French Northern Africa if they could beat Hitler there.
The French were very, very angry. The defeated French, I should say, were very, very angry at the British because when they surrendered to the Germans in 1940, the British wanted the French Navy, which had retreated to the southern Mediterranean, to surrender and give themselves up to the British so that they could be used in warfare against the Germans. The French refused to do so. They were going to abide by their armistice, their surrender to the Germans. And the British actually fired on the French Navy at Oran in North Africa in Algeria. And they captured ships in Alexandria in Egypt. The French were outraged by it. And as a result, our attempt to go into French North Africa had to be led by the Americans because the British were just not acceptable to the defeated French.
Stanley Weintraub is my guest. He's Professor Emeritus of Arts and Humanities at Penn State University and author of Pearl Harbor Christmas, A World at War, December 1941. If you'd like to join us, you can call now to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Our guest this hour is Stanley Weintraub, Professor Emeritus of Arts and Humanities at Penn State University, whose new book is called Pearl Harbor Christmas, A World at War, December 1941. You could be part of the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Stan, we should talk about the worldwide media coverage of this summit between Churchill and Roosevelt, how this was perceived in different parts of the world, depending on which side of the war they were on.
No one took seriously the Churchill-Roosevelt visit in Axis countries. Churchill was considered as a desperate man making this trip over to America. And, of course, misleading one's people is very typical, and the Japanese did the same thing. Rather than cover the visit of Churchill to Roosevelt in Washington, the Japanese at the time that Churchill arrived in Washington displayed pictures in their newspapers of the attack on Pearl Harbor. Planes from their Air Force had taken pictures, and a couple of them are in my book, pictures of the raid, and they were on planes on aircraft carriers returning to Japan. The planes flew off the carriers when they got close enough to Japan and reported in Tokyo so that their pictures could be used in the press. On the other hand, celebrations occurred in, of all places, Hiroshima Bay, when the ships returned just before Christmas. This was the headquarters of the Japanese fleet. And they were not interested in Roosevelt and Churchill meeting. As far as they were concerned, they had won the war. And their own people were convinced that the war would be a quick one because they had done so much damage that Americans would be apathetic about the war and that if the defeats, one after the other, didn't cause Americans to be defeatist, they would inflict more defeats on them, and they expected the war to last less than a year. So there was no interest in Japan over Roosevelt and Churchill. On the other hand, Germany derided this visit of the two, saying that they were really helpless, the war would end soon, and England would be invaded. Of course, England would never be invaded, and in fact, the effort to invade England had been called off about a year earlier because the Germans didn't have enough shipping to be able to cross the channel with troops. But people are always given a different picture of events. Even we were given a different picture of events than actually occurred. I was in eighth grade at the time, and as a boy, I collected bubblegum cards called war cards. They were like baseball cards.
Wow.
But they were bubblegum cards, and number one was General MacArthur. This was just after Pearl Harbor that they got produced in a big hurry. They were poster-like. Number one was General MacArthur. Number 15 was Churchill. I still have those cards. I have 200 of them. And in fact, I have a few of them in my hand right now. And those cards show a different picture of the war. We're winning the war, according to this.
In every card, I bet. Yeah.
On all the cards, we're defeating the Japanese. Hmm. Three U.S. pilots, one card says, face 108 Japs and shooting it down all the Japanese planes, which, of course, they didn't do. And another card shows a seaplane tender in the Navy, you know, in the Pacific, fighting off a Japanese bomber. The Japanese bomber turns out to be a Pan American Clipper. They didn't know what a Japanese bomber looked like. So it was a four-engined Pan American seaplane Clipper that had been used on the Manila route. This is the picture we got of the war, because we didn't know, and if we had really known how bad things were, we might very well have been more defeatist.
What an interesting time to have been a child in your formative years. I would imagine that maybe you and your schoolmates dreamed of glory in the war as your parents were praying it would be over by the time you were old enough. I mean, is that accurate?
Oh, some of my classmates, by the time I got to high school, dropped out of school to enlist. Mm-hmm. They were so eager to get into the war. One of my senior classmates was actually killed in action before I graduated. He had lied about his age and gone off the war.
Wow.
So this was a bit of enthusiasm after the isolationism and the pessimism. The day after Pearl Harbor, the recruiting offices were jammed with people wanting to enlist. I was about the youngest of my cousins, and one of them tried to enlist and couldn't. His feet were too big. The Army would not make special shoes for it. And he was very embarrassed walking around in civilian clothes.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones now to Lee in Fort Worth. Hi, Lee.
Hi, how are y'all?
Very well, thank you.
I have a couple of questions for your guest. One is my mother had told me that prior to the war, we had done a booming business in scrap metal with the Japanese, or some industrialists had, and that had come back in the form of Japanese planes and bombs. The second question I had was there was a rumor that Howard Hughes had designed a fighter for the Army Air Force, and the design had been rejected, and this design was based on his transcontinental aircraft, which is in the Smithsonian. But the Japanese Zero bears a remarkable resemblance to it, particularly the back half of the aircraft. I was wondering if either one of those were true.
The Japanese actually never copied any of our aircraft. They did better than that. The Japanese Zero was a better fighter plane than we had for some years until we had the Grumman Hellcat fighter. But you're certainly right about scrap metal. We were selling oil and scrap metal of all sorts to the Japanese until shortly before Pearl Harbor, when President Roosevelt finally said, that's enough. The Japanese will not make any peaceable efforts in Asia, and until they do, we have to stop sending them scrap metal and oil. And the Japanese claimed that was one of the reasons they started the war, that they were short in raw materials, and we had denied them those raw materials. But we were also getting things from Japan, although hardly the stuff of war. An interesting story, at least I think it's interesting, that I tell in Pearl Harbor Christmas, is that General George Marshall, the chief of staff, had the British Army and Navy senior staff to Christmas dinner at Fort Myer near Washington, and General Sir John Dill, the former chief of the British Army, was there as one of the guests and told Mrs. Marshall, I've never had a birthday party because my birthday is on Christmas Day. And Mrs. Marshall sent General Marshall's Sergeant Powder out to look for a birthday cake with candles. And he came back despite Christmas Day with a birthday cake and candles and miniature flags, British and American flags, to put on them. And as they sang happy birthday and blew out the candles and pulled the flags off the cake, they discovered that the flags read Made in Japan. So we were buying things from Japan.
What kind of trade relationship existed between Japan and Germany?
Very little because of the distance. Mm-hmm. The Germans tried to get supplies from Japan that they couldn't get in any other way. And the Japanese reciprocated and tried to get what they couldn't acquire themselves from Germany. The Germans stopped building two aircraft carriers that they had tried to create. They had no aircraft carriers. And the Japanese tried to get the Germans to ship the aircraft carriers to Japan where they would be finished. But there was no way they could have made it that distance without being destroyed. And the Germans gave up on that attempt.
And Hitler...
At the end of the war, let me mention, mm-hmm. This is, I think, interesting. At the end of the war, the Germans, who had failed to build an atomic bomb, but had nuclear material available, they had uranium, wanted to send it to Japan before they surrendered. And they sent uranium aboard a big submarine on the way to Japan. But just as the submarine was going through the North Atlantic, the radio message came that Germany had surrendered and all subs were to surface and surrender to the Americans. And so the submarine went to the surface and surrendered. Two Japanese aboard said, if you surrender, we will jump overboard or we'll commit harakiri. And they did commit suicide. But the uranium got to Portsmouth Navy Yard and was very likely used on our bombs.
Hitler and Hirohito obviously both wanted to see the United States brought to its knees, but they did not really trust one another. Is that accurate?
I really didn't understand that question.
Germany and Japan, they were allies to the extent that they both had this enemy of the United States, but they didn't trust one another particularly.
No, they didn't trust one another, and we can see that in the diaries kept by people on both sides. I use the diary of the German naval attaché in Tokyo to represent that. He had a difficult time even getting his German sailors off their ships in Japan to see Japan because the Japanese didn't trust them. And the Japanese often didn't pay their bills to the Germans. It was a case of having shared enemies but not trusting them, not trusting the people who you claim to be your allies. We did the same thing. When Russia was attacked by Germany, Winston Churchill got on radio and said, anyone who marches with us is our friend. Anyone who marches against us is our enemy. And so communist Russia suddenly became our friend. Not that we trusted them.
Let's go to the phones now. We'll speak with Walt in Dallas. Hi, Walt.
Hi. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Sir, I know this is a little off the Pearl Harbor central discussion, but can you tell me why in the world Hitler, who had some intelligence, would begin a war with Russia, knowing that Napoleon had failed, World War I, there was failure, and other instances, that trying to incur into Russia was just a failed proposition. And so he would divide his forces between East and West.
Well, first of all, Hitler was a bit crazy. But other than that, Hitler thought that Russia was rotten to the core and would collapse. And he felt that if Russia collapsed, he would then gain tremendous agricultural lands in Ukraine in particular, and the oil of the Caucasus. He wanted both because he felt that that was the only way to be able to outstay England in the war. But, of course, he turned out to be very wrong indeed.
During this visit, Churchill experienced some really debilitating chest pain. How serious were his health problems at the time?
Churchill had health problems throughout the war, largely pneumonia. But he did have a heart attack while in the White House, and his doctor who was with him, Charles Wilson, later named Lord Moran, said, "Oh, don't worry about it. You'll get better. Just take it easy." He never even lowered Churchill's drinking habits or his smoking habits. Churchill went on as a heavy drinker, as a heavy smoker, and only 24 years later was the heart attack at the White House revealed.
And he was, the drinking is, you're not understating this, he showed up at the White House and essentially handed over a list of the kinds of alcohol he would need at his side 24 hours a day.
Yes, he told Alonzo Fields, Roosevelt's butler, that he needed to be awakened with a tumbler of sherry every morning. and he also needed 90-year-old brandy. He wanted scotch and soda all day and champagne at dinner. And he also smoked constantly. Eleanor Roosevelt, Mrs. Roosevelt, had to keep opening the White House windows in winter because of Churchill's heavy smoking. He really was the proverbial man who came to dinner.
So talk, we just have about 30 seconds left, but about the conclusion of the visit and what happened after Churchill was home and how the war progressed from there.
Churchill did not go home right away. He left the White House and went on a recuperative trip to Florida briefly. And General Marshall went with him so they could keep discussing military affairs because Churchill was his own defense minister, which is one of the reasons why the war was bungled so often by the British. Churchill was not a very good defense minister. He came back to the White House after that and did not leave until mid-January to return to England. But he had accomplished everything that he wanted. He had gotten the Americans to retool more rapidly than they expected to in providing military equipment and ships. He had gotten the Americans on his side about fighting Germany first, and he had gotten the idea into the Americans that French North Africa had to be invaded as a way to establish a second front to take the heat off Russia.
The new book by Stanley Weintraub is called Pearl Harbor Christmas, A World at War, December 1941. Stan, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
You're welcome.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Christine McConnell produces the podcast, and our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast at kera.org/think. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.